Fourth case for argument this morning is Intercon Solutions against Basal Action Network.
One of the ladies were out of the mess.
Just hold on a second, Mr. Phillips. The rustling will die down soon. I assume they're not leaving because they've read the briefs in this case.
If they had, surely they would not be leaving.
Right. It is my fond hope that this case does not last 28 years.
Actually, I had it longer than that. This is the first trial I've ever had.
All right. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am John Phillips, and I represent the appellants in this case, Basal Action Network and James Puckett. The court is asked to determine, is this appeal appropriate as a collateral order? It is asked to examine whether or not the Washington anti-SLAPP statute, SLAPP standing for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation, is in fact enforceable in a federal court sitting in diversity.
I would like to go about this backward fashion. If I understand your argument, it is that the anti-SLAPP statute is enforceable because it is substantive rather than procedural. It gives the defendants a defense.
That certainly is a part of my argument, okay. Correct.
Assuming that that's true, I don't then see how we can have an appealable order, because the collateral order doctrine to which you appeal refers to orders that are collateral to the merits. But your argument here is not one that's collateral to the merits. You say we're entitled to win. And one might think, therefore, that the collateral order doctrine is not available.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with you for the following reason. We aren't appealing the denial of a order under the anti-SLAPP statute for a special motion to dismiss as having not been made out. We are appealing a decision by the district judge that it is not enforceable in federal court. So we can't...
Well, that's one reason for not having a defense recognized, but still a defense.
Well,
suppose this were a different kind of libel suit, and the defense is that under New York Times against Sullivan, the complaint fails to state a claim. It's a constitutional defense based on the First Amendment. And the defendant says, under Times against Sullivan, a public figure has to plead actual malice. This complaint must be dismissed because it doesn't allege actual malice. And the district judge then says, I don't think the plaintiff is a public figure. The motion to dismiss is denied. Can the defendant immediately appeal?
No, of course he cannot.
Well, why is this any different? The anti-SLAPP statute works in libel actions, something along the lines of New York Times against Sullivan. And if a defense under New York Times against Sullivan cannot be the basis of an interlocutory appeal, why can a defense based on an anti-SLAPP statute be the basis of an interlocutory appeal?
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First, your supposition that in fact we have a district court order here that concluded, a la New York Times versus Sullivan, that the elements of the anti-SLAPP motion to dismiss were not met, as in the same case of New York Times versus Sullivan.
The district court has rejected the anti-SLAPP statute as a defense.
Pardon?
The district court has said the anti-SLAPP statute does not give the defendants the defense they seek.
Right, but the order...
It's given a particular reason, but the court has rejected a defense.
Well, Your Honor, the order, which is 60 pages long, does not decide that it's not a defense for any old reason. It does so for one reason, because the Supremacy Clause holds, according to the district court, that the anti-SLAPP statute is not enforceable in federal court.
Yes.
Well, let's be more specific. It doesn't. It holds that 525 is not enforceable.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's all we're talking about. 525 is not enforceable in federal court because it allegedly conflicts with Rule 56. So for purposes, to answer your question then, Judge Easterbrook, in order to evaluate whether this order is appealable, one does not hypothesize what the district court could have done if the court had not concluded that the Supremacy Clause strikes down this statute in federal court. One evaluates what the district court did do. And what the
to follow up on Judge Easterbrook's question for a moment, counsel, if it's a collateral order, how could we grant the relief you're asking for, which is to dismiss the complaint as a matter of law and award you your fees, costs, and statutory damages?
Well, Your Honor, the manner in which you could do that, although I recognize that in this context, the court could easily remand to the district court, having reversed the district court. But I believe the answer to that question is that because it is de novo review, and it is a
if that's the relief you think you're entitled to, how is this a collateral order?
Your Honor, the order is an order saying that the statute is not enforceable in federal court. You may rule that it is enforceable. You should rule that it isn't enforceable in federal court sitting in diversity because it does not conflict with the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure. If you do no more than that, then it is clearly a collateral order. Now, you have asked me if you also want the additional relief of having the case dismissed. My answer to that is the case is before you, and you do have the right in de novo review context to conclude that the case should proceed no further.
If there is nothing here except procedure, how would we be entitled to do anything on the merits?
When you say that if there's nothing here except for procedure, what do you mean, Your Honor?
More lost. I notice that at least one party asked that, and I assume it was you, asked the district court to certify an interlocutory appeal under 1292B.
Yes.
And the district court entered an order saying that was moot because your client had appealed anyway.
Yes.
I don't understand how that can be moot. You know, what something is moot if it can't possibly have any effect on the outcome of the case. I think the discussion that we've had so far shows that an argument about an interlocutory appeal under the Cohen Doctrine might well fail in this court. And in that event, 1292B could well have an effect on the outcome of the case. So the district court was plainly wrong to declare that the request for action under 1292B, was moot. It might be of assistance to both parties and the court for one or both of you to return to the district judge, inform the district judge that a request under 1292B is not remotely moot, and ask the district judge to reconsider that issue.
Well, Your Honor, the reason, of course, we did file the direct appeal was because there was a 30-day time limit in doing so. I did, consistent with Your Honor's comments in a previous appeal this morning, alert the court that we had 30 days in which to make that decision, and she, in fact, indicated that she would rule, but apparently because of the press of business did not. We have no control over the
and no one will be heard to argue that you have forfeited that point
thank
by failing
you.
And to annoy the district judge.
For that much, I'm grateful, Your Honor. But the point here is this. You're starting from the position, Your Honor, that this is not a collateral order because it is a summary judgment-like procedure, and whether you win
sure
or lose
I
on that.
I understand your response to my suggestion.
Okay.
It is, of course, within the power of both parties to decline to ask the district judge to reconsider the 1292B position. And if that's what happens, we will decide whether there is an appealable order.
Are you done, Your Honor, on that point?
I'm asking whether you are done.
I'm not done, Your Honor, because if this court were to conclude that the court's conclusion...
We're not going to go in sequence, counsel. We're not first going to decide under 1291 and then consider an appeal under 1292B.
I wasn't suggesting that you do so, Your Honor. And if, in fact, you decide that the way that this case should proceed is that it should go back and the court should reconsider 1292B...
No, I just said we are not going to decide first under 1291 and then consider the possibility of an appeal under 1292B.
Right.
That would be folly.
Right.
If there is going to be an appeal under 1292B, it is going to be now. We will defer action in this appeal for a little while to see if the district court is willing to certify under 1292B, if anybody asks. But we are not going to have two interlocutory decisions in this case.
If that's the court's conclusion, and if you speak for the panel, then I think I have nothing more to say. Thank you, Your Honor.
He does.
Pardon?
You don't want to argue the merits?
Well, I do want to argue the merits, but I misunderstood.
We are not going to have another 1292B proceeding.
All right.
If the district court certifies this order for interlocutory appeal under 1292B, then the merits will be decided regardless of the outcome of the Cohen issue. If the district court does not do that, then we will have to decide the Cohen issue.
I understand, Your Honor. I appreciate it. I had not appreciated the nuance of what you were saying. So, there are two points then. The first point is simply that the court should not conclude that there is any complete collision between Rule 56, this court's rule, and the Washington anti-SLAPP statute. Why? Because there's nothing in Rule 56, its text or otherwise, which concludes that this rule is the only means by which a case can be dismissed, that it will govern the burdens of proof, or for that matter, that discovery will be necessary prior to ruling on the motion. Rule 56 is a means of deciding a case pretrial, but there are a lot of other means of deciding a case pretrial through Rule 37 sanctions for spoliation, for failing to prosecute under the court's local rules. Rule 56 does not, Your Honors, identify the exclusive means for pretrial disposition of cases in the same way that in Shady Grove, the court concluded that the language and text of Rule 23 does give permission to bring a class action if these criteria are met. And so in this context, the court should join the four other circuits that have unanimously concluded that there is no collision between this rule and the anti-SLAPP statute, such as Washington's anti-SLAPP statute. Now, there is a nuance with respect to the Shady Grove case because five of the justices, led by Justice Stevens, also concluded that you need to look at, even if you saw a potential collision, whether they can be reconciled. And just as Judge Posner said in this circuit, in the Healy case, if in fact there's a means of reconciling the two, you should do so. And in this case, it's easy to do that. In this case, we don't have an objection to the limit on discovery under the Washington anti-SLAPP statute. Could I get some water?
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you. We don't have a... excuse me. We do not have any kind of real argument here that the limitations on discovery matter because both parties agreed to stay discovery in the case. Burdens of proof traditionally are state substantive provisions. Just as Your Honor pointed out with respect to the New York Times versus Sullivan standard, malice is a standard that's imposed with clear and convincing evidence in the context of a public figure defamation case. There are different burdens of proof first placed on the defendant who's being sued under the Washington anti-SLAPP statute and then on the plaintiff under the Washington anti-SLAPP
Counsel,
statute.
Counsel, I think we understand that burdens of proof are substantive. But let me ask, on a special motion to strike, if a district judge sees an affidavit from the plaintiff saying, for example, I was there when the container was opened and there was no electronic waste in it, and another witness from the defense submits an affidavit that says, I was there and there was electronic waste in there, what is the district judge supposed to do under the motion to strike and on a motion for summary judgment?
Well, on the motion to... Well, let me first state, you are, in fact, raising a hypothetical I hope you appreciate, because there, in fact, is no evidence from anyone...
However we rule, it will apply to that hypothetical.
Fair enough. With respect to the question of if you have competing evidence, then the question would be, does the plaintiff, Intercon, establish with its evidence clear and convincing evidence of a probability of prevailing on the case? If they present sufficient evidence that on each of the elements
you've got
of their
one
claim...
You've got one affidavit from each side that directly conflict with each other. What's the district judge supposed to do? And we would have de novo review, right?
Well, you would have de novo review for sure. Okay. But what the district judge would decide, of course, would depend on what those affidavits said.
I've given direct contradiction on an essential element.
Then it probably would need to be deferred. You would need to move forward on the merits, and the motion would need to not succeed in truncating the case and burdening the defendant with litigation, because you have the plaintiff has actually come forward with actual evidence showing that their claim is real, and they have tangible evidence proving it, and that it was false. And in this case, that my client had malice, which they'll have to show. And
if this is all true, then why is a regular Rule 56 motion not sufficient for your purposes?
Well, I think there are two points I'd make, Your Honor. One is that if you're thinking generally, certainly the Washington statute does provide for an expeditious process and a presumption.
Is that, by the way, is that expeditious process binding on federal courts? The time limits in subsection 5?
Well, the time limits in subsection 5, there are two points. One is time limits themselves are not binding under section 5. It's within 60 days or as soon thereafter.
Not for filing, for court action.
That's the 7-day rule. I don't believe that's binding on a federal court, and certainly no one has argued it's binding on a federal court here. And if it were, then we'd have an entirely different case since the case was under submission for 7 months, not 7 days after the motion was submitted. But I do think the point I wanted to raise with respect to the question of de novo review, you still have a different burden under this statute, clear and convincing clarity as to all elements being shown by a prima facie case. So the Washington defense, just like other defenses like immunity under federal law for judicial officers and public officials, increases the burden on the plaintiff early on to come forward with evidence to show with convincing clarity that they have a prima facie case. So it is somewhat different. It is a summary judgment-like procedure.
Right. Well, what is? Let me try again.
Sure.
Why are you not satisfied with simply filing a Rule 56 motion here? You can file a Rule 56 motion at any time under the rule, right?
Right. You asked the question, could you achieve the same purpose through a summary judgment motion? The answer, of course, is possibly. But that doesn't mean that the Washington anti-SLAPP statute is either invalid or an inappropriate means, because there are advantages under that statute.
Tell me the advantages.
One of the advantages is the one I just mentioned, that the burdens of proof are higher on the plaintiff to establish a prima facie case for their claim under the Washington anti-SLAPP statute as a defense to the defendant than they would be if it were just a straightforward suit under Illinois law for defamation as to the elements. The burdens are higher imposed, just as the burdens are imposed in, for example, a Norr Pennington context to show that the suit was not a sham. That's a different burden that a person would normally have in a defamation case because of the First Amendment overlayer. And the Washington statute similarly places an additional burden on the plaintiff to establish a prima facie case than they would had it been raised solely in the context of a summary judgment motion with the elements of the claim asserted solely under Illinois law. I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Could I ask you, Mr. Phillips,
certainly,
to address Byrd against Blue Ridge Rural Electric, Supreme Court case that the plaintiffs have cited? There was a state law that provided that a judge would decide a particular statutory defense to a particular class of tort cases. which sounds a lot like a special motion to strike. The Supreme Court held that that was a procedural requirement that could not be applied in federal court.
Well, I think my direct response to that, Your Honor, is that there are four circuits in six panels, all of them concluded that this...
I'm citing the Supreme Court.
No, I understand, Your Honor, but the four circuits have all interpreted United States Supreme Court case law and concluded, not in an analogous case, but in this particular context...
Yeah,
that
counsel, I would really appreciate it if you would answer Judge Hamilton's question, which had to do with the meaning and effect of Byrd against Blue Ridge.
Right.
Not four circuits, but a particular decision of a particular court.
Your Honor,
that we must follow.
If I can be more responsive, my answer is that the difference is that there the court did conclude that it was a procedure, whereas I believe the United States Supreme Court in this case would conclude that the qualified immunity associated with the Washington statute is a substance with procedural attributes.
This is not, 525 is not qualified immunity. It's a procedural device. If I understand the motion correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
If the motion is denied, it has no further effect in the lawsuit.
And that's true, Your Honor, because the qualified, and it is a qualified immunity, I disagree with you in that regard. The district court agreed with us in that regard. It is a qualified immunity that applies at the beginning of the case, because what you're trying to protect is against the burden of
litigation. Qualified immunity is a substantive defense, correct?
Yes, it is.
If the defendant can show that his or her conduct did not violate clearly established law at the time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But I don't see the substantive component of the motion to strike under 525.
It's substantive in the same sense that the North Pennington defense and the sham defense applies under the First Amendment. Now, I don't want to quibble with respect to is it technically an immunity, but it serves as an additional burden or hurdle.
It's a procedural hurdle. There's no doubt about that. But the question is whether it's a substantive immunity.
The sham defense is not a procedural hurdle in the North Pennington context, Your Honor. It is a substantive right a defendant has when they are petitioning the government not to be sued. And 525 is exactly of the same character. It emerged out of the North Pennington defense. Does it have procedural components? Absolutely. But the defendant has to show that they acted in a manner that was public participation. They have to prove that they qualify for the right to that First Amendment protection. And in that sense, it is exactly like the North Pennington Doctrine and the additional burdens that a sham defense imposes on a plaintiff suing for First Amendment conduct.
Before you sit down,
yes, Your Honor.
You've raised the North Pennington Doctrine. Let me ask you what happens if the defendant imposes a North Pennington defense to a particular complaint and the district judge rejects that. Is that immediately appealable?
It is not. It is not.
Well, if in your view the Washington statute is just like the North Pennington doctrine, or is really the same thing in a slightly different guise, doesn't the fact that we know that North Pennington defenses are not the subject of immediate appeal important here?
No.
In the absence of a 1292B certification.
Well, I don't want to wade into those waters other than to say this, Your Honor. The difference between the fact that a denial of a summary judgment motion under North Pennington is not appealable and the Washington anti-SLAPP statute is obvious. The Washington anti-SLAPP statute gives the party the direct right to appeal.
No, which that it certainly does not.
It does, Your Honor.
It does not apply in federal
court. Well, that's a different question, isn't it?
No way that can be applied in federal court.
Well, it's the reason
okay,
why...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Mr. Schneeringer.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stan Schneeringer. I am here on behalf of the Appalee Intercon Solutions. I wanted to address a couple of points that came up towards the end of counsel's argument, specifically Byrd. In that case, the Supreme Court was called upon to decide whether a workers' compensation statute, which gave the judge, the district court judge, the power to decide whether the company meant a statutory definition of employer, whether that transition of a fact-finding role from the jury to the judge could be enforced in federal court. And the Supreme Court in Byrd held that it could not, not only because it was procedural, but also because the Seventh Amendment required that that issue be decided by a jury, that there was a jury trial as to a disputed issue of fact. And that is true even though the court in Byrd specifically referred to the state statute as protecting a state immunity. Irrespective of the fact that the state saw this as providing an immunity for certain employers, it nevertheless required a finding of fact, which could only be done by the jury. And that's why Byrd, I think, is directly applicable and perhaps controlling here. The question, another reason why immunity, or that question of immunity, has come up is whether or not it whether styling the Washington procedure as an immunity can allow for an immediate appeal. And I think the answer is no. The mere fact that Washington says there's an immediate right to appeal in Washington courts may indicate that they want to provide some additional procedural protection in Washington, but of course they can't create appellate jurisdiction in the federal court system. And if that's all that we look to determine whether we should consider this as an immunity, then that sounds an awful lot like a state statute by providing for an immediate right of appeal in state courts is creating federal appellate court jurisdiction. The Knorr-Pennington Doctrine does not apply here, although the court's point is well taken that
Mr. Sperrier, could I just ask, would you agree that the requirements of 1292B are satisfied here?
That the requirements of 1292B are satisfied? No, I do not.
Why not?
Well, this is not an interlocutory order within the list.
I'm sorry. Let me be more specific. Do you agree that the legal issue presented here meets the requirements of 1292B so that it would be appropriate for the district judge to certify this, as Judge Easterbrook was suggesting earlier?
I think that that's within the discretion of the district court judge. I think the answer should be no, that this is not an issue of sufficient importance to reach this court immediately, and that
even though the district judge disagreed with other circuits on the merits?
I'll just go ahead and say this is a perfect candidate for 1292B certification. You may quote me to the district court. Okay?
The point's well taken.
Why don't we then go on to the merits?
Okay, the merits. The Knorr-Pennington Doctrine doesn't apply here. I think the analogy doesn't really hold because that applies directly to cases in which the speaker is petitioning the government. And there has been no government petitioning here. Despite the assertion that this is that Ban's actions were intended to prevent the environment protect the environment and prevent a violation of the law, there was no reporting to any environmental protection agency. Instead, the only speech was to various members of the press. The court asked, what is the benefit of the anti-SLAPP statute? Over the course of the argument, the anti-SLAPP statute in Washington, and let me step back a bit, not the anti-SLAPP statute, but Section 525 special motion to strike, because the court's point is well taken that that's what we're here to address, not the statute generally. Up until recently, the position that the anti-SLAPP statute, or the position as to what the anti-SLAPP statute provided, was that it imposed some burden on, or some obligation on the district court to weigh evidence. Clearly, if it's requiring the district court to weigh evidence or make a probability finding, a probability of a likelihood of success on the merits, we would argue that that violates the Seventh Amendment, or, as Twombly has said, asking a district court to make a probability determination at the outset in order to determine whether it
violates the Seventh Amendment.
Well, if
does the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995 violate the Seventh Amendment?
I'm not aware that it does, Your Honor.
That statute has in it some features in common with Section 525.
Mm-hmm.
It requires special pleading of special identified matters. It requires the district court to resolve those pleading issues ahead of everything else and dismiss the case if the pleading requirements aren't satisfied. And the Supreme Court said that it also changed the substantive grounds and required the district court to apply this new rule on the pleadings rather than on evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't see any hint in the Tellabs opinion that the Supreme Court thought that that requirement was unconstitutional.
And I don't think changes to the pleadings burden, and I have to confess I'm not entirely familiar with the securities litigation. I'm not a securities lawyer, but
there is or can be a very close interaction between pleadings requirements and the merits. Rule 12b-6 obviously shows that, so does 12c. The PSLRA is a case where Congress, like the Washington legislature in Section 525, fiddled with pleading requirements in an effort to affect the merits. No, for what it's worth, orders under the PSLRA are not subject to interlocutory appeal. You've now just said this is all a violation of the Seventh Amendment. Yeah. I'm wondering whether that is going to, how many federal statutes that's going to take out in your view.
If all this did was affect the pleading requirements,
it combines, pleading requirements are addressed to the merits. One way of having an effect on the merits is to require pleading of new things. That's what, according to Tellabs, the PSLRA did. It changed the merits by changing pleading rules.
But that's not what Section 525 does. Section 525 wants the district court to review evidence.
I'm trying to get at a constitutional argument you were making. I can't figure out how, if this Seventh Amendment argument is right, we can avoid holding unconstitutional something like the change in the PSLRA. And I'm sure there are more.
Because the Section 525 is asking the district court to weigh matters outside of the pleadings.
That's exactly what, according to Tellabs, the PSLRA does. Exactly.
Decides disputed issues of material fact outside of the pleadings without a jury? And on that, dispenses with the case on the merits and denies the case the opportunity to go forward? Again, I'd have to review the authority that Your Honor is referring to because I don't know it specifically today. But that's the concern here. And I think that there is a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial whenever there's a disputed issue of material fact and the parties are legally at issue.
Counsel, let me ask you about the conflict you've argued between Rules 12 and 56 and Washington Section 525. Is it accurate to say that your argument is in essence based on a perceived conflict implied from silence? That is because, or can you direct me to particular text in Rules 12 or 56 indicating that they're exclusive or exclude something like 525?
My argument is this, that if Section 525 requires something more than determining whether as a matter of law there is a disputed issue of material fact, then that would require the weighing of evidence. If it only requires determining whether there's a disputed issue of material fact, which has been advanced, there's also been the advancement that there's the additional changing of the burden of proof, which we can address, but if all it requires is determining whether there's a disputed issue of material fact, then I think by definition it conflicts with Rule 56. We have a rule for that.
Point me to the text. The argument on the other side is that Rule 12 and Rule 56 are, in essence, only options available to defendants, mm-hmm. but that there are other options can be provided by state law.
To do identical things to Rule 56?
To allow pretrial rejection, dismissal of a case on the merits.
Well, I think that in the Rule 56, I agree, there is nothing that says, and if you get through Rule 56 motions, you will have a jury trial. The background law of the Seventh Amendment has said that if the parties are at issue legally, and if they have demonstrated that there is an issue for the jury to decide, i.e. a genuine issue of material fact, then the right to jury trial attaches. So I agree, it is not in the language of Rule 56.
If so, why shouldn't we try to figure out a way to, if we don't have a direct conflict between the state statute and the federal rules of civil procedure, why shouldn't we try to find a way to accommodate them?
If there are substantive aspects of the state statute that can be applied without disrupting or without conflicting with the rules of civil procedure, I think that that can be done.
So point me to the conflict.
Well, the conflict is that we are having, we are using a state procedure that they're arguing is essentially the same as summary judgment. At the same time,
well, they also want to argue it's better than summary judgment, so it's different, okay? We have to, I think, assume that it's different, although there are issues yet to be worked out by the Washington courts.
The difference, the burden of proof, the shifting of the burden of proof.
Okay. Burden of proof is substantive.
Agreed that burden of proof is substantive. And if this were a claim under Washington law against a Washington defendant applying Washington defenses, I think that my argument would very well be different, that despite the fact that a procedure is not necessary because Rule 56 already exists, that Washington does have the ability to shift the burden of proof for claims under its own law. This isn't, however, a claim under Washington law. The plaintiff's claim is brought under Illinois law. And can Washington, under the guise of creating an affirmative defense, reach out and alter the burden of proof applicable to an Illinois plaintiff bringing a claim under Illinois law? I would argue that it cannot, that there's no extraterritorial effect to argue to laws like that.
I'm not sure I follow that, but do we have any indications about whether in Washington state courts the Section 525 special motion to strike is available to claims being brought under defamation or other tort laws of other states? That was something that was very important to Justice Stevens in the Shady Grove in his concurrence.
Yeah, I have not seen a case in which it has been or in which a court has said, yes, we will apply it or no, we won't, simply because the fact setting hasn't come up. I do think that on its face, it applies or it purports to apply to claims brought under the laws of other states, and that I think is a hallmark of what makes it procedural. I don't think that it can, as a matter of law, create a different burden of proof for an Illinois claim, but that is, I think, what it purports to do. And the reason why this all came up in the first place is the district court looked to the doctrine of depassage to determine whether we were going to apply different law to different issues in this case. And it was agreed by all parties that Illinois law governed the claim brought by the plaintiff. The court said, well, we will also apply Washington law to defenses because this is a Washington defendant. Depassage divides a case up by issues. And I would argue that the burden of proof is a single issue to be decided by one state's law over another. It was already admitted that Illinois law governed Band's claim, and that the burden of proof, therefore, is dictated by Illinois law. The only benefit, it's argued, to the Section 525 motion to strike is altering that burden of proof. And I would argue that that is not something that a Washington law can do, at least not outside of Washington courts, and certainly not in federal court. The issue came up about conflict with the rules and whether the fact that this Section 525 only applies to a certain category of cases excuses it from the idea that there might be a conflict with the federal rules. The court's decision in Healy was brought up specifically. And you know, Healy made the point that if the state rule was so intertwined with a procedure that the state right was so intertwined with a procedure that might conflict with the federal rules, but that was a different question that Healy refused to answer at that time, and it called it a more difficult question. I think that's the question that's here today. I don't think Healy provides any guidance. And also, the federal rules, this was pointed out in Shady Grove, apply in all cases. The fact that there might be a conflict only in this limited set of cases, these defamation cases or anti-SLAPP cases, however you want to phrase it, that doesn't save Section 525 from being in conflict with the federal rules. Your Honor,
to go back to this issue of conflict, counsel.
Yes.
I haven't heard, I guess, a clearly articulated theory of conflict here. It's different from the federal rules, but many courts have looked at this and said, we can treat this, I think the Ninth Circuit's phrase was an alternate theory for disposing the case. I'm not sure how it's an alternate theory. It looks to me like an alternate procedure. But given the split votes in Shady Grove, we've got a challenge ahead of us here. Could you comment on Chief Judge Kaczynski's analysis of this problem, on the relationships between Rules 12 and 56, and how this sort of motion to strike works?
Well, I think Judge Kaczynski has pointed out the Twombly problem that I raised a little earlier. On the face of the statute, the face of the statute says that the burden is going to shift after a defendant has made its showing as to the nature of its speech, that the burden is going to shift to the plaintiff to show by clear and convincing evidence a probability of prevailing on its claims. And what Judge Kaczynski pointed out was, here you've got Twombly in interpreting the plausibility standard, saying, let me tell you what plausibility is not. Plausibility is not the district court determining whether the plaintiff is ultimate success on the merits is probable. That is forbidden to the district court. That's the key problem, I think, that Judge Kaczynski sees, is that on its face, however other courts might want to say, oh, this is only summary judgment, I think Judge Kaczynski is saying, no, it's requiring a district court to make a forbidden probability determination. Now, he raises other issues as well.
Unless, of course, some statute changes that rule. That's one reason why I brought up the PSLRA and the Supreme Court's holding in Telabs, mm-hmm. that a substantive change can require a district judge to make exactly that determination at the pleading stage.
Well, of course, I mean, one difference that leaps to mind, of course, is that's Congress. You know, Congress making rules applying to federal causes of action in federal courts, not the Washington legislature changing rules applying to suits at common law. And in fact, maybe that's where I've really been missing it, is the Seventh Amendment applies to suits at common law, and that's what this is. A defamation claim is a tort that existed at the time the Constitution was enacted. The Seventh Amendment secures the right to a jury trial in that instance. Well, rather than belabor any other points that have already been made in the brief, if the court has no further questions, then Intercon will stand on its briefs. We do ask that the court affirm the district court, and I thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Phillips, your time has expired, but we asked a lot of questions, so I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's very generous, Your Honor. Thank you. I'll direct myself to the point you asked about Judge Kaczynski, Your Honor. I think he made a couple of points in his objection to the conflict. One is he looked at Rule 12 and Rule 56 broadly, and he characterized them as being sort of universal with respect to pretrial procedures for dismissal of cases. I think that's just simply wrong. You could dismiss a case under Rule 37 as a sanction. There are lots of ways that district judges dismiss cases, usually in negative context for one of the litigants, but not in the context of Rule 12 or Rule 56. And as you pointed out, there's no textual analysis similar to Rule 23 that justifies that decision. Judge Kaczynski also focused on the discovery bar as being troublesome, and frankly, that's not an issue here because they agreed there should be no discovery before this could be decided. They thought they had the evidence going in, and so they didn't need any discovery. And then finally, on the dépeçage argument, I'll simply point out for purposes of this court's analysis, the plaintiff didn't appeal that part of the court's decision, didn't appeal anything. There was a decision that Illinois law applies to the claims, Washington defenses apply, and your point, Judge Easterbrook, is quite right. Under the district court's decision, Section 510 was applied to eliminate a claim with respect to all communications with respect to the government. Now, that's not shifting the burden of proof. That's eliminating the claim, which is sort of one step higher. And all 525 does is it shifts the burden. So it's somewhere between barring absolutely and conditionally barring subject to a heightened burden of proof, which either a state legislature can do and is enforceable in a federal court sitting in diversity, or the Congress can do with respect to federal claims. There is no difference in that regard. I appreciate you giving me the extra time, Your Honor. I have nothing else unless you have any questions for me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.